Live from CDC headquarters in Atlanta, this is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. So if you have the following symptoms, you should go see a doctor. Sudden chills followed by feverish sweats for days on end, joint pain, headaches, waves of nausea. You are probably not feeling those things, though. And for that, you can thank the institution where I am now sitting. 70 years ago, malaria was so bad in the southern United States that a new government agency was formed in Atlanta to fight the disease.
Remember, there is only one cause of malaria, the mosquito. Destroy the mosquito and you will wipe out the disease. Then, in place of sickness and poverty, there will be health, safety, and happiness.
The battle against malaria led the organization to many other causes, like sexually transmitted diseases, tuberculosis in the 1950s and 60s. Today, we have the country's foremost public health institute right here on Clifton Road in Georgia's DeKalb County. And we are here to celebrate the 70th birthday of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's a special show for us because we get to honor the work of the people who work every day to keep us safe from global health threats. Many of them are in the room with me right now. So let's hear from you. Good morning, CDC. We will start things off with an update on CDC research from the person in charge. CDC Director Tom Frieden is with us today. And if you have questions for him or any of today's guests, you can tweet it to us. It's at OST Talk with a hashtag CDC70. So, Director Frieden, thank you so much for being with us today and happy birthday.
Well, welcome to CDC and thanks for doing this.
You look great for 70. To start off on a sobering note, I mean, in light of the news that we've had over the past week, and especially last night from Dallas, one of the things we've talked about a number of times in the show and sometimes with employees from the CDC is whether or not we can get good research on guns as a public health issue. And I wonder what kind of questions you think we could answer should Congress free up funding for that kind of research?
Understanding firearm violence is important in order to prevent firearm injuries and death. And over the past few years, we've asked Congress for $10 million a year to do research into firearm violence in things that I think everyone can agree on, such as reducing injuries to children through the unintentional exposure to violence or to guns. But until Congress funds that, we're not able to do that type of research.
Which is a difficult situation for a scientist when you have to make a political argument in order to make scientific research. How does that complicate your work?
We try to stick to the facts. We are America's agency that protects Americans from threats, whether they're infectious or non-infectious. And we understand that ultimately many decisions do depend on politics. We try to stay out of that and provide the best available information so the decisions can be taken that are most likely to protect Americans.
So let's go back. The CDC has had some incredible victories. I mean, we already spoke about malaria, which can only be described as a huge public health triumph. Then there's also the fight against polio. What do you learn from things like that, malaria and polio, that help you when you confront things like Ebola and Zika?
CDC has had seven decades of firsts, and while we have had a lot of progress against malaria, including saving millions of lives over the past decade, that's part of the President's Malaria Initiative, it's still a major problem around the world. So one sobering lesson is that our work is not done. The only area where our work is done is really just about smallpox, because in smallpox we were able, working with a global coalition, to eradicate it from the world forever. And a disease that killed hundreds of millions of people should never again kill anyone. And we don't have to vaccinate against it either, in general. Now, we are a little bit concerned as a potential bioweapon, so I've got a little footnote on smallpox. But we're also very close to that with polio. We're at the finish line of the eradication of effort on polio.
And that's how close, when you say close, what does that mean?
We have gone from 350,000 children disabled by polio each year when we began the effort in 1988 to 74 cases last year. And it's only present in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we hope we'll be able to get over the finish line there possibly this year.
So let's go back to Ebola, and it appears that the fight against the current strain of Ebola is largely mostly successful. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But I wonder what kind of lessons you take away from that, and especially in terms of communicating with the public. What kind of things can you improve?
First off, it's key to recognize that Ebola didn't have to be as bad as it was. If the countries of West Africa had had core public health services, it wouldn't have become an epidemic. It could have been stopped there, as it was stopped in many countries in Africa, because we had strengthened their disease detection and control programs. So the first thing to understand about Ebola is that it didn't have to be this bad. The second thing to understand is that it could have been much, much worse. If Ebola had gotten out of control in Lagos, Nigeria, where there was a cluster of cases, it could have exploded all over Africa, and we could still be dealing with it.
Now, because the population is so large and so dense.
Absolutely. This is the first time we've seen an urban Ebola epidemic, and that was in Monrovia and other parts of West Africa. But it didn't get into Nigeria, which has 10 times the travel and a much larger population. If it had gotten out of control in Lagos, it likely would have spread throughout Nigeria and elsewhere. So I think that the really three things we have to know are, first, every country needs to be able to find a health threat when it emerges and stop it quickly. Second, when a country is overwhelmed, we as a world have to be able to surge in rapidly and stop it before it becomes a regional or global crisis. And third, healthcare infection control, preventing the spread of infections in hospitals, is really important and not easy. And we need to do a better job of that all over the world.
Now, here's where we get into some of the more modern complications, especially because when it comes to getting people to get the vaccines they need, to getting people to understand symptoms, and frankly, to be afraid of the right things, that requires you educating the public. And I find it interesting that now we have people who are called science interpreters that are sort of interpreting science for the scientists to make it palatable to the public. How do you bridge that communication gap?
Well, I think all of us need to be better at stating things clearly. We shouldn't hide behind fancy words.
Right.
But at the same time, we shouldn't oversimplify. There are things that are complex, and sometimes people want a simple answer, and there isn't a simple answer. Or people want a definitive answer, and there isn't a definitive answer. Let me give a modern-day example. We're dealing with Zika. Yeah. Zika's a new threat. We have never before identified a mosquito-borne disease that could cause a birth defect. Never happened before. And literally, every single day, we're learning more about Zika. At the same time, we have to give recommendations today based on the best available evidence today. So we're in the position of saying, here's what we know as of today, here's what we don't know, here's what we're doing to find out, but this is our recommendation and this is what we're doing to find out more. And tomorrow we could change that recommendation if we learn more. That can be very frustrating to people, but that's how science works. That's how the world works.
So what is your biggest challenge? Knowing that, sometimes that challenge changes from year to year, just like the flu vaccine seems to change from year to year. I know that we're not always great at predicting what flu is going to come up, but I wonder what's the biggest obstacle you have?
I think the biggest obstacle we have at CDC is that what we do is really good for everyone somewhat. But it's not something
it's not a great tagline. No. What we do is really good for everyone,
kind of. Let me finish. We work 24/7 protecting Americans. And when we're successful, you don't see what we do. And the efforts that we undertake are efforts that are needed everywhere and all the time. It's a round-the-clock monitoring, response, investigation, prevention. Many years ago, a great public health leader said, public health is purchasable. Within natural limitations, a community can determine its own death rate. But that means that a community needs to come together, and whether it's clean water 100 years ago, or clean air, or ensuring high vaccination rates, these are things that all of society benefits from. But the advocates for this, the people who recognize this and will forcefully push it in when it comes to funding or regulatory advances that keep people safer, that's something that doesn't necessarily have a strong lobby, if you will. So we lack the kind of strong advocates that some individual causes have for the general strengthening of public health. That may be a philosophical or political analysis,
well,
but I think that is
complicated.
But I do think that is our biggest challenge. We're fortunate that there are many people in Congress who do understand how important CDC is, who do understand that we are about keeping Americans safe and healthy, that we're a best buy. But the way our political system works, it may be difficult for us to do things that have specific major benefits because the advocacy for them isn't as forceful as the advocacy for some other thing.
And the answers aren't as simple.
Well, sometimes they are, right? Don't smoke. That's pretty simple.
But one that seems a simple, something like obesity is not good for you, ends up being complicated because we get very different answers from different scientists about how to eat properly, right? I mean, nutrition seems to be very complicated and up for debate.
There are, broadly speaking, two types of things that we could consider doing. One is proven policies. It's just a matter of the political or financial will to implement them. And there are lots of those that could save a lot of lives. That's why, for example, we launched the Million Hearts Initiative. We can prevent a million heart attacks and strokes over a five-year period by doing what's proven to work but not being done today. There are also areas, including obesity, where we don't have all of the answers. And in those areas, it really makes a lot of sense to try things and see what works. We talk about evidence-based practices, but we also need practice-based evidence where we try something, see if it works, and if it does, we learn from that. Now, there are some areas within nutrition where there is not reasonable doubt. For example, artificial trans fats increase your risk of a heart attack and don't have any benefit. You can get rid of them without altering the taste, increasing the cost, or doing anything else negative, and you're going to save a lot of lives. Reducing sodium is very clearly indicated, and reducing sodium can be done in ways that people don't miss it. The only thing they'll not experience is a heart attack or stroke.
We have a couple minutes left, and I wonder, does the CDC have the funding that it needs to cover all of the possible things that might kill us?
I think you heard from our local audience the response
to that. A laugh is not a comment.
We take seriously that every dollar we spend is a dollar that somebody worked hard to earn. And we take seriously our role as diligent stewards of the funds entrusted to us. Public health is a best buy. If you look at immunization, every dollar we spend saves $3 in healthcare costs and $10 in societal costs. And many
Wait,
of our
could you go back and say that again? Every dollar that you spend on public health prevention?
On immunization specifically, and many of our other programs have a similar return on investment, or ROI. Every dollar we spend returns $3 in healthcare savings and $10 in societal savings.
Oh.
We are a best buy, and the more resources Congress entrusts in us, the more we can empower Americans to live longer, healthier, more productive lives.
It's a bargain. That is Tom Frieden. He is the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.